Welcome to Short Story Today, where we celebrate short stories and the authors who write them. I'm John DeSavino, and I'll be your host. This week, we celebrate South Carolina author Dustin M. Hoffman. His stories have appeared in the New Ohio Review, Gulf Coast, Diagram, Fiddlehead, Alaska Quarterly Review, One Story, and the Saturday Evening Post, among others. He is the author of the story collections 100 Knuckled Fist, which was the winner of the 2015 Prairie Schooner Book Prize, No Good for Digging, and the chapbook Secrets of the Wild. Today, I'll be reading his story, Smoke at the End of the World. But first, let's listen to my interview with Dustin, which took place on January 5th of this year. I'd like to welcome Dustin M. Hoffman to the podcast. How are you today, Dustin?
I'm doing great, John. Thanks so much for having me.
We're going to be talking about your new collection. Such a Good Man is about to be published by University of Wisconsin Press. And we're going to be talking about that today. But before we do, I'd like for you to tell the listeners a little bit about yourself, Dustin, where you grew up and how you found your way into writing fiction.
So I'm from Michigan, originally Alma, Michigan. I know this would be an audio podcast, but I'd lift my hand up and, well, I'm doing it now and like pointing where I'm from. That's what we do in Michigan with the mitten. So
Michigan is known as the Mitten State.
That's right. That's right. So yeah, central Michigan, Alma, Michigan, which is like an hour north of the capital, Lansing. Small town, like 10,000 people, pretty rural. There was an oil refinery there that's now shut down and like chemical factories. So pretty working class too, or at least used to be. I think most of those businesses have left, which is kind of like influenced my work a little bit too, since I write about work so much. But I lived in Michigan my whole life, and I eventually went to grad school in Bowling Green State University in Ohio, and then moved down to South Carolina, where I've been for the last 9 years. But yeah, I grew up and really love Michigan. I'm glad to be away from there right now in January. It's like the worst place to be, but yeah. You can't beat the summers in Michigan. And then how I came to writing, I suppose I was writing pretty early on as a kid. I wrote like a novel about my weird hair fox terrier dog being like a ninja dog, because like Ninja Turtles were big. And so that was like the first novel I wrote when I was like 8 or 9 or something. And then started writing poetry when I was a teenager, and all of that was such terrible stuff. But luckily then when I got into college, I was really avoiding being an English major and being a writer. I don't know, it seemed like I should be doing something more practical. But I got into a great creative writing workshop with the writer Adam Skytema, who's just a fantastic Michigan writer. I can't recommend his work enough, but he was super supportive and kind of set me down that path. And then I worked with Jamie Gordon. She won the National Book Award in 2010 and was a fantastic mentor. And so I had great teachers that really like affirmed that I was meant to be doing this thing. And I think that's so important for so many writers, to find like that teacher who understands what you're trying to do and helps you do it better.
Yeah, you know, studying with someone who has an impressive track record, it's always nice to be able to drop their names in these kinds of conversations, but it goes well beyond. So many of those people have become mentors to writers like you and have made an invaluable contribution to the whole field of writing by bringing people like you along. You are now in the world of academia. Is it a graduate creative writing program that you're in?
Yeah, Winthrop University. I direct our small master's English program. So we have a small MA and then a pretty robust undergraduate English major and creative writing minor. But yeah, I was lucky to work with great teachers. But I will say, like beyond the name dropping, it's kind of a curse too, to work with great teachers, because now I feel like I have to do for my students what these teachers did for me, and they worked so hard line editing my work and really like putting a lot into the workshop feedback. So like Jamie Gordon was so great. And then Wendell Mayo at Bowling Green State University, who passed away a few years ago, so unfortunately. But he was just an amazing teacher. And I feel like I have to channel that and honor the effort that they've put into it. But it makes the job hard when I think when you've had these great teachers and great workshop experiences.
Yeah, but I think you're rising to the challenge, Dustin. Clearly, you are an incredibly prolific writer, and prolific doesn't always mean a great writer, but in your case, I believe that you are a great writer. And in having read Such a Good Man, I appreciate you giving me a chance to read an advanced copy of that. My head was spinning reading this collection. I have so many questions for you. It's going to be hard for me to choose what direction to go in with these questions, but I'm really looking forward to talking about these stories. But before we get into the stories, I wanted to ask you about what it's been like working with a university press, because you have three short story collections. It will be three full-length story collections. You also have a chapbook, Secrets of the Wild, and the University of Nebraska published two of your books, and now you have the University of Wisconsin publishing Such a Good Man. So what's it like working with the university press as opposed to something like Word West? Secrets of the Wild was published by Word West, right?
Yeah,
And
and they did No Good for Digging as well.
No Good for Digging, which was the collection just prior to Such a Good Man from 2019. So what was that experience like working with the university press, and how did it differ from working with the other small press that you work with?
Well, Nebraska was pretty big. I mean, it was my first experience when 100 Knuckled Fists came out. But yeah, it was great. I had a publicist assigned to me. There was a copy editor, an amazing book designer. I had very little to do with like the book design. I remember them like I got a questionnaire with suggestions for the book design, and I remember like thinking so hard about it, like, oh, it should be like maybe a picture of like a house painter on top of a ladder in a like decaying subdivision in the background. And it ended up just being like a text cover and an amazing one. Like, and I'm so glad they didn't listen to me. Like, I'm a writer. I'm not a book designer. They did such a great job with that. And like the copy editor I worked with just taught me everything I don't know about hyphens and dashes. And like I thought I knew a lot about it. Like even having two hyphens in 100 Knuckled Fist was a big like debate. And we went like down the rabbit hole to like, prove the grammar of that or figure it out. So yeah, that was a great experience and a robust staff at University of Nebraska Press. And I always felt really supported. And working with Word West, I also felt really supportive, but it was much more collaborative. I was their first book, the debut book for that press, which has put out just great books since then. But yeah, we went back and forth on the book cover a lot more. And I'm so thrilled with their little kind of candy colored shovels on the front of it. It's like so captures the surreal and the working themes that are in that book. But that was great. I think we even like marketing ideas collaborated a lot. Me and David Queen out there, the founding editor. So it's been great to like work with I think University of Nebraska Press is I believe it's the oldest Midwest university press in America. So they've been around a long time and have put out a lot of books. And then to work with somebody just starting from the ground up. But I couldn't recommend it enough, for new authors to get these experiences working with these different levels of small presses where you have so much involvement and yet still a lot of support too. And so far, Wisconsin has been great as well. Like there's a story in there, the man with the yellow hat, that's kind of a retelling of Curious George or a parody of it. But like we had to go down a legal rabbit hole, like is this within fair use? And their legal team was able to determine that it was. And there's a book out there put out by I think Harper that's called By Curious George. That's
I love it.
so
Well,
yeah. So if that book exists, I think we're okay.
In the area of parody, in my understanding, it's fair game. All of those things are fair game if you're parodying them. And I love what you've done with that story. Let's talk about it since you brought it up. It is a parody, and it really takes the children's book and goes about as far into the real world of pain and anguish and adult problems as you could possibly take it. And George has become a liability to the man in the yellow hat because he's as we know monkeys can do, has some problems with his behavior and sometimes, you know, is out of control and does violent things. Yeah, just talk about that story, because it really does stand out in that way. There's nothing quite like that story in the collection, that, you know, in terms of you taking on something as iconic as a popular children's book like Curious George. How did that come about?
I have two daughters who are 10 and 8. And so we were reading a lot of Curious George books, and I love them. Yeah, we love them. They're so near and dear to my heart. But then, you know, you read them as a kid and then you read them as a parent, and there's such a different perspective on it. You start thinking about, like, oh, the man with the yellow hat had to deal with a lot of shit.
Like, literally and figuratively.
What a mess.
Yeah.
Yeah. How does he... You know, oh, there must be lawsuits. And so, you know, and the story is kind of the beginning of the premise of the story is the man with the yellow hat is pushed to extremes and he's considering euthanizing George. And so, you know, I was thinking about killing off the beloved Curious George. Spoiler, I guess he doesn't do it. I think it's okay to give that spoiler in here. But, you know, I think it was my interest in reading those books from a parent perspective was what inspired that piece. And it's really, I think that story is so much about the parenting perspective, like the other side of it, you know, like even raising small kids, like the outsider thinks, oh, they're so cute and they're so fun and you must just be having a great time. And like, yeah, there's all of that in there, but also like, it's so stressful and challenging and never like what the storybooks and the parenting books promise. You know, there's a lot of turmoil in there, but it's like, it's a love that's worth earning. And I hope that comes across in the story too. So yeah, it's about a monkey and a man, but it's also, I think, about like coming to terms with being a parent.
Yeah. Yeah. That could definitely comes through. And that's a risky thing to do, to take something so familiar to people and turn it on its head like that. You know, you could fail spectacularly, or, you know, you could succeed spectacularly, and you just handle it so deftly. It's funny, it's moving. You know, it's kind of fun that we started out with that story, because it really is probably the most unusual story in the collection in terms of it being parody. Nothing else would really fall into that category in the collection. I want to talk about the stories that, which are many in this collection, and evidently in No Good for Digging, they appear as well. You know, stories of working class guys. I'm just going to read from the blurbs for No Good for Digging, because I found them really interesting. Seth Fried, the author of The Municipalists, thought that you were a Sherwood Anderson for our time when he read that collection. And William, is it Lychak, author of Cargill Falls? He called the stories an elegy to the theory and practice and meaning of work. These are stories not afraid to get their hands dirty. So you obviously have a real affection for working class guys, because you were one. You know, in your bio, you mentioned that you spent 10 years working as a house painter. You have such deep feelings for these people. And I just wanted to ask you about that experience of being a house painter in Michigan. And that, I think that was during the Great Recession of 2008, when the housing bubble burst and work kind of stopped in the housing market.
I worked right up to it. I was doing construction and had my own business even for a little while in the near the end of my construction experience, where we were building subdivisions and we couldn't build them fast enough. That's when, you know, those subprime mortgages were going out that led to all this mess. So, you know, I benefited from it. And there's a weird sense of like survivor's guilt, I think I have about a lot of it, because I got out of it like just before the recession in 2007, I started my MFA and left, you know, put all my painter whites and all the tools away and hope to never go back to them. And, you know, and then while I'm going through grad school and staying in touch with my construction buddies, they're losing their jobs. The contracts are disappearing. I remember one of my buddies saying, the subdivision that we were building in Holt, Michigan, which was by Lansing. He's like, you wouldn't believe it. There's just foreclosure signs and for sale signs. Like the whole subdivision is that, you know, and we just built these homes a year or two ago. So yeah, I mean, I have a lot of affinity toward working people. Although, like, I always try to be careful to strike the right balance. Like, I don't want to simply like glamorize that life because it's cruel. Like, especially in construction, there's a lot of problems with how that runs in America. Like, I'd say residential construction, most contractors, most tradespeople are working on like 1099s as subcontractors. So, like, don't have any employee benefits, don't have any job security, don't have any retirement. And like, I think America really chews up its construction workers and spits them out. And that's why, like, we still can't find them, right? The 2008 recession left them all behind, and we've never gotten, you know, that construction worker workforce back up. So, you know, I try to be honest about that. And also, like, there's a lot of gross toxic masculinity and bigotry that goes on these job sites. And at the same time, like beautiful, smart, wise people that don't show up in literature enough. So, I mean, I've been talking about that, but 100 Knuckle Fist is also a lot of work stories. And I'll go to my grave writing work stories. Like, I'm fascinated in these people. And I feel a sense of duty maybe associated with the survivor's guilt to tell the stories too of these people that probably won't have the privilege and opportunity that I do to share them. So I keep like researching people's jobs and trying to capture like those invisible voices and make them show up in the stories. But this, I'd say this collection especially has a lot of recession stories, or like workers coming right up against the recession or having just survived it. And that's a little different than my other collections. This one's a little more timely and looking at that weird 2008 bubble, the, you know, just before it and after it.
Yeah. And that feeling of, you know, job insecurity for people who are working those kinds of jobs is much more acute than for a lot of people in other fields. Because, you know, they know that this could be their, at any moment, this could be their last job for a long time. And you really capture that anxiety for these characters in these stories. They are so real and authentic. And I imagine you worked with some real characters. So do you have characters that you modeled on people that you worked with? I would imagine you may have.
Oh, yeah. You know, I'd say every character is kind of a collage of people I knew and voices, you know, scraps of dialogue. Or like, there's this one guy I worked with, a dear friend, Chandler, who would always, he was a drywall finisher and like one of the best I've ever seen. He was so good. He was an artist. And once when I asked him about like, you know, what's your secret? I remember him saying, you got to listen to the mud, man. and I always love that. Like, what poetry in that? And I think there's that, I use that line in a story in 100 Knuckle Fist, but like, that is like, that's a line that's spoken to so many of my stories, like this weird sense of lyricism that might be in the working class trades for like the really great workers are so tuned into their tools and materials that they can hear it. So yeah, there's certainly a few characters, and they kind of, even if they don't have the same name, are kind of recurring, like these echoes of people I used to know. But yeah, I think you have to tap into that and then like pair it with imagination and compassion. But yeah, that's certainly, there's certainly influence from real experiences.
Even though these people may not be educated, some of them are extremely smart and, you know, turn out to be philosophers and people you can learn from, right?
Yeah, I have my brother-in-law is a CNC worker, does machine cutting, and he's giving himself quite an education. This last year, he's been listening to audiobooks and going through like the literary canon, getting all my recommendations. It's great. But like, he's reading faster and more than I possibly can. And I'm kind of amazed, like he's becoming more well-read than me. Because he's listening all day long, and just a brilliant guy. This is a shout out to Boston Brew, but yeah, I think, and you know, he's emblematic of so many people I worked with. There are those stereotypes and assumptions about working people, I think, and you know, education levels and such. But like, I worked with so many people that had these like unique senses of self education and wisdom, and yeah, I try to capture that in the stories too. Mm.
Yeah, and the other fun thing is the code of conduct among like blue collar workers, right? There's this, you know, sort of unspoken way that you're expected to behave, you know, lines that you shouldn't cross. And you obviously, you know, have plenty of experience. You may have crossed a line here and there too in your own experience and gotten, you know, a look or a sharp remark from somebody.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was always this this assumption with house painters that like we had the easiest job on the construction site, because like we're like sitting on carpet in air-conditioned homes, and like we're the last ones that get to work in a house. And the number one rule on a job site is you never say that your job is harder than someone else's, right? Like that'll lead to a fight worse than anything else. And yeah, you see those kind of like those show up in Such a Good Man, those lines and those codes of conduct, and in like The First Woman, a bunch of construction workers, and they're like telling stories at a point. I think I have a line in there, some lines about like, no one trusts a house painter though, because like they're all cover up and exaggeration. So if you want like the truth, go to a frame carpenter, right? Like they're all lines. And
I actually pulled that quote out because I thought that was so perfect. Yeah, let's talk about The First Woman. That's a great story. And in the story, these guys who are working on a job, which could possibly be their last job, they have been introduced to a female construction worker called Winona. She runs like the backhoe. She's the one who digs the holes that the foundations are poured into. So she is like, she's taken on this kind of mythological importance to these guys. They fantasize about her. And she's, you know, she's a character. She has a cowboy hat and aviator sunglasses and a ponytail. And she's a badass, obviously. But when they don't see her, they worry that their jobs have dried up. So in this story, they haven't seen her, and they have one guy up on a ladder with binoculars who's trying to spot her. And this is where that line comes from. They want to get somebody up there on the ladder that they can trust. House painters are prone to exaggeration. They choose a life of color and cover up. It's so funny that you brought that same quote up, because that just jumped out at me. I had to write that down. So yeah, that really captures what we've been talking about, that existential dread for these guys of, you know, if this woman goes away, so do our paychecks, and how are we going to pay our mortgages? This has a really wonderful ending. There's almost like a literal deus ex machina in this with her and her backhoe. So maybe if you could just give us a little bit of an insight into how that particular story came about.
Yeah, well, you know, I think like I was talking about earlier, that anxiety about like, where will the work come? And this story is happening like just post recession. So like, here are workers really like paranoid and vulnerable in this state of like, will this happen again? And I hope that like the entire, especially these stories about like recession suffering and anxiety speaks to today's workforce too. Like, I think we're in it again, right? We've been anticipating, are we going to have another recession? What's going to happen? And so far, it looks like we're doing okay. And I hope we will. But yeah, this story speaks to that kind of anxiety. Like, since, you know, there isn't the contracts or the guarantee of a job in the future, it's just left to like reading the tea leaves, right? It's like the worker before us, if they show up, then we know we have more work to do. And that's kind of like all one has to go on in construction sometimes. The inspiration from this, I will say again, is real life. There was, I remember in Holt, there was a woman contractor, and I can't remember if she wore a cowboy hat or not, but like she was always by herself and like working this like super heavy machinery, you know, knocking down trees and digging holes. And I never met her. We never talked to her, because like a house painter and an excavator couldn't be more separated by time and trade. But she, you know, to us, she was like mythological, like, wow, what's she doing out there? And we're going to work there next. Like, I wouldn't have guessed the builders had bought that land. So that was like that little scrap of inspiration to roll with this story. And then, of course, like that story structurally is in a collective first person point of view. So it's a we story. I'm really prone to writing these. I just think it's like so organic to the working story is the we voice, since so much of what we do is in collective. Or like there's a tension for me as a fiction writer. I really love the point of view tension of like there's a we group and, you know, the I is kind of straining to like find their identity within that group, or like the I is pushed out of the group eventually. And I think that's happening in this story too. Like there's especially one guy who's like trying to get answers from Winona, and that's kind of like entrenched in the plot of this story. So the I and the we separating.
Right. Yeah, there are so many surprises in the story. Then that one character who ends up developing a very unusual relationship with Winona that the guys can only see from a distance. So they're trying to figure out like what's her agenda. You know, is she gonna like crush this guy or is she gonna give him a break? Because he's trying to find out, you know, what the story is, and he's been sent as their emissary, and it's hilarious. It's so much fun. So there's humor, there's pathos in this story. Your stories can be just straight up funny. And you do some experimental stuff, which I wanted to talk to you about. You have a story which is written in the form of baseball cards, Orville Killen, Career Statistics, which is a really playful story. It's satirical and it's funny, but it also turns out to be a very touching story about this man kind of breaking away from his origins, being able to be a pro ball player and not end up in the coal mines like his family had been stuck doing for decades. So there's, you know, there is some pathos in this story too. But yeah, just talk about the choice to go that route, you know, the ball card route with this story.
Yeah, I think I'm a really like form-driven writer a lot of the time. I've been working on and publishing, in fact, a series of stories told in the form of resumes that are about working class American mythological figures. I've done like a Paul Bunyan one and a Rosie the Riveter and a John Henry. So like, you know, in those ways, the form can really inspire the piece. And that's where, you know, this Orville Killen story as well, I started there without knowing like where the story would go at all. Like just baseball card backs are so fun. And I will admit on this podcast, like I'm a, you know, 40 something year old man that still collects baseball cards.
It's okay. It's okay. Really, Justin, you're not alone.
So but what I love about, yeah, thank you. Right. I think that actually at this point, like those are the only people collecting baseball cards. Like the industry has become so expensive, and yeah, it's kind of sad. But yeah, I've always, as a kid, I loved baseball card backs, and especially the stat lines on like a Topps baseball card tell their own story, the numbers of that. And then there'd always be like these really bombastic, overly enthusiastic blurbs, like even about crap players that like would have a horrible career, but like Topps or whatever baseball card company would find something nice to say or interesting to say. And so I wanted to appropriate that, also that voice that's, you know, kind of unreliable in a way. And then like I kind of stumbled into like, what about off season? So this story is paired with like an on-season baseball stat card with then like what happens in the off season, and I'm making up ridiculous statistics for, you know, yes, going hunting or like, you know, grieving over one's mother and things like that. But that was a lot of fun, just to like, I guess I was asking myself what this voice and form could do, but then also like the story that numbers can tell and trying to tally things. And, you know, I think we're, you know, whether you like baseball or stats or not, I think so many of us are drawn toward trying to make sense of our lives in this quantitative fashion. Mm. And of course it's kind of impossible to do, but like, I hope the story captures the compulsion to attempt that.
It does. And what's so wonderful is that when you started to change what the statistics were, that was such a surprise. This guy's a middling ball player. He's not like a big star. You know, he kind of holds his own, But he has his high moments, you know. You kind of show his peaks and his valleys in this career through these little vignettes on the backs of these ball cards. I've never seen anything quite like that. So I have to say, yeah, do more of that stuff. I think people will really respond to that kind of thing. Certainly middle-aged guys, right?
I hope so. I remember I got a really nice rejection letter from the from Michael C. Curtis at the Atlantic, which was such an honor on this story. And he said something like, it's a cool story, but it requires too much effort from the reader, you know, if they weren't baseball fans. And I so appreciate that. And Alaska Quarterly Review ended up publishing it later and like took a chance on it. So I'm glad to hear it's resonating. And I think it does have a lot. I hope it has a lot of payoff for not just baseball fans. But let me tell you, I did more research for that story than maybe any other I've ever written. Like, I was looking up actual box scores from actual baseball games to, like, you know, so I could have some basis for real stuff. And then, like, some of the stats, I did real research into that. Like, I think there's a number of, like, the number of hairs on a fox's tail. Like, that information is not readily available. I had to go deep dive into, like, you know, amount of hairs on a square inch on average on these animals and, like, figure out these numbers and, you know, for one statistic. But
you did your homework and it paid off because, yeah, there's a character, the mother comes up in the story who taught him how to hold a bat. And she's always, I guess she wore this fox fur kind of scarf all the time, which comes up in the story. So yeah, the details add so much, you know, those little details create such vivid pictures in the reader's mind. And yeah, you packed a lot into those baseball cards. So kudos to you.
Thanks, Jim. Thank you.
You brought up the subject of research. And that's something that occurred to me while I was reading these stories. You seem so knowledgeable about so many things in these stories. And then when you write a story like the title story, Such a Good Man, which focuses on meth addicts, that came as a real surprise because I was kind of scared that you seem to know so much about the life of a meth addict. So let's talk about that story for a little bit, because those characters, they stand out from the rest in that they are real down and outers, the two characters at the center of that story. And it's a more plot-forward story than most of the other stories as well. There's a missing child it's a children's amusement center, these bouncy castles. This company goes around setting up these different bouncy castles. And a child goes missing, and the parents are obviously very anxious, and they're about to call the police. And there are some shady characters that work these carnival kinds of operations, right? But those are not the people who are at the center of the story. One of them is an employee of this operation, but the other is her dealer who has gone AWOL, and they're concerned that because of his history, his past, that at least the central characters, the narrator, is concerned that he may have something to do with the disappearance of this child. Anyway, I don't know if I'm doing justice to the plot. But yeah, maybe if you could just talk about those characters and how you were able to embody those people, because they're very different than these other kind of more noble characters that show up in your other stories.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And thanks for that plot synopsis too. It is like a pretty tangled plot. And as you noted, probably much plottier than most of the stories I write, which makes me like that story a lot too. And it made sense for me for that to be the title story for a lot of different reasons. But yeah, it's like my attempt at a thriller.
Yeah.
And that, you know, there's like some scraps of inspiration there. Like in South Carolina, these like bouncy house palaces pop up all over the place. It's probably especially like a good Southern business that maybe works less successfully in a place like Michigan, where like half the year, there's no way you're going to be able to move your bouncy houses around from park to park. But yeah, we have them a lot in South Carolina. And I remember, I think when my daughter was maybe four, we lost her for minute or two.
Oh,
and
my
like
gosh.
A, you know, it was just pure terror, you know? And I think, you know, of course I could tap into that. But yeah, these characters, There's certainly some questionable ones in here. There's, a potential pedophile too that like is left fairly ambiguous in the story. There's, the meth dealer that he was kind of terrifying to write. And at the same time, I hope I was able to draw out some humor and heart, which makes him scarier. But the main character, Eggie, like I love her. She's one of my favorite characters in the collection. A recovering addict who's like really trying so hard to just do the right thing in these kind of impossible circumstances. And this even though this story takes place in the South, where I think there is plenty of meth addiction and problems with that, we saw a lot of that in Kalamazoo and Western Michigan, again, around the recession and just following it. That was quite an epidemic there. And I'll just plug Bonnie Jo Campbell, one of my favorite writers who lives in that Kalamazoo area. I think she lives in Comstock, Michigan, but she writes about meth addiction far better than I do, and has done probably more research. I promise, Mom, I haven't done meth.
Yeah,
I just researched it a lot,
just
but
to make that clip very clear.
right. But yeah, I think that was such a fascinating and troubling regional epidemic, really. I think a drug that really was plaguing more working class folks as well. So it was one I was interested exploring in a story like this, where there are so many kind of tangled elements in here to cause problems for dear Peggy, who I love so much. I often tell my students one of the I love Kurt Vonnegut, and one of his pieces of writing advice is no matter how much you love your characters, do terrible things to them so that we can see what they're made of. And if you test their mettle, they'll be all the more interesting. So I threw a lot at Eggie in this story.
All these characters are memorable, but she is particularly memorable, Eggie. I was just speaking to another writer who's written screenplays about, the lens through which people read stories and novels. And, for me, I love films. I see stories kind of unfolding, not all stories, of course, but certain kinds of stories like this one unfolds visually for me. And this is a very cinematic story for me, as a reader. I see this unfolding in my mind. And this leads me to the question, just before we started the interview, you mentioned that you had had a story of yours turned into a film. So can we spend a few minutes just talking about that experience? Because I'm very curious about what that was like for you.
I've even thought about Such a Good Man, thinking about film adaptations with it, because the crew I'd worked with before, we're hoping to do something again in the future. And Annie Dillard says, "You can always smell the rat," she says, when a novelist is like writing a novel and hoping it'll get made into a movie. You can smell a rat.
That's great.
And so and I you know I don't think about that much. And in fact, screenwriting, I kind of hate the form because I love interiority, but you don't get to do that in screenwriting, right? But you count on good actors and cinematographers like pulling off the implication of a character's thought. I like the control. Like I just want to put the thoughts on the page. But we thought about Such a Good Man, and I've even put together a screenplay for This Picture of Your House that we might try to tackle down the road. But yeah, Touching in Texas was the film that we made of my story with the same title from 100 Knuckled Fist. And that was a really fun experience. It was with a lot of other faculty members at Winthrop University that we put that film together. And there's so much collaboration involved. And there's so much a fiction writer doesn't think about too, of like, I can do whatever I want, right? Like I have an unlimited budget for like setting and props. And then all of a sudden, once you're making it a film, the director looks at you and like, how are we going to do that? And so it requires a rewrite. And that was really interesting. Or like thinking about how interiority driven I am, trying to pull that off in film. And then eventually it's like, we're going to have to rewrite this and find a way to include some of that in dialogue and some of that in action. I mean, that was a really fun process for me to be doing rewrites on set once I could see like what we'd need and what the film would need. We came into it with a screenplay, but then adapted so much from there. one of the lead actors in that. Like, she did so much work. She came up to me and like, this is what I was thinking about the character's history. Like, I think she did this in her past. And I was like, wow, that's awesome. Like, none of that's on the page. But like, to get to collaborate with these artists who are thinking about the primary text in these ways that make it more expansive was such a delight. And then I even got to be somewhat active on set. It was a small budget. So like, I was holding up those screens that like let the light show on things and, you know, feeling what, how much your arms hurt after doing that for a long time. But it was, yeah, it was a fun experience. I'd love to do it again.
Did you do the adaptation yourself in this instance?
Yeah, I did. Before I knew really anything about screenplays too, since then I've taught some screenwriting classes and I use David Trottier's Screenwriter's Bible. That's pretty great. I'd recommend that book, if nothing else. Like, he's so great on just formatting. I feel bad for the crew I worked with for the first film. Like, I didn't even know the format very well, so I was just kind of making it up. And they were very kind to me and using everything. But yeah, it was a great experience. And I think I could do so much better now with everything I know. But that's like everything, right?
Sure.
You know, writing a story or you know, painting a house. It's, you know, through experience and putting the hours in is how you get really great at your art.
Yeah, books are great, but there's nothing like real life experience to teach you how to do anything in life, pretty much, right? We're running out of time, got a few more minutes left. So I want to talk about the speculative stories in the collection, because they kind of show up late in the collection and they come as a real surprise. And the one that really kind of knocked me for a loop was Bicuspid. It's almost a horror story in some respects. It's quite surreal. And it took me a moment to adjust as a reader to what was happening in that story after having read all these other stories, which are pretty much all grounded in reality. I mean, you do kind of push the envelope in a few of them, but this one really went all the way out there. So maybe you could just talk about writing speculative stories and the thing that you enjoy most about being able to kind of explore those realms of the unusual and the unreal.
Yeah, I love it. The real experimental magical stuff. Like, I write a lot of it, and this collection is probably more grounded in realism. And I'm so grateful to my agent, Heather Carr, who has worked with me a lot on putting this collection together and like winnowing out stories. At one point, it had a lot more magical, weird, speculative stuff in it. And we kind of got it to this state that's much more grounded in realism. And I think that's the right place for this. But I think it's still, especially stories about work and grief, require these jumps into the irreal and surreal. Because like working construction during the recession was a really surreal experience. Like you think you have this 9-to-5 job that you can count on, and all of a sudden there's nothing, right? The economy has collapsed. There are no more jobs, and your life completely transforms in this magical, absurd, cruel, crushing way. And Bicuspid is, it does have some construction work in it. One of the main characters is a roofer, but it's largely about the grief over losing a child. And, you know, as a parent, there's no greater grief or turmoil that one could imagine. So, of course, as a fiction writer, I got to write about it.
Yeah.
I got to figure out what to do with it. Yeah. And the story, I this isn't spoiling anything. It's right at the beginning. It's the kind of initial premise is these separated parents are meeting to pull teeth out of the other person's mouth and then put those pulled teeth into their own mouth. Until, you know, and they do this throughout the story. It's, yeah, it's horrific and terrible. And I always want to think of a way to like, oh, there's the old cliche of show, don't tell, right?
Right.
But maybe better to find a way to concretely dramatize something as abstract as grief. So, you know, what's more horrific than like pulling teeth, right?
Oh.
To at least me, you know, I have a lot of dreams about losing teeth and teeth falling out. I think there's a psychological readings of people that have these dreams.
Yeah, I think most people have had those, me included. Yes.
Sure, yeah. It's horrifying, right?
Yeah.
And I think we need more dental horror in the world. So
maybe that's part of the problem.
Yeah. You know, I think it's the meanest story I ever wrote. This couple is like horrible to each other, but you know, beyond the teeth pulling, they say the worst things that one could possibly say. And, you know, in a relationship, like all the filters are gone, right? It's like every married couple, I'm sure, like they understand the things you can't say in a relationship. They've taken all those guardrails off and are just hurting each other in every way. And I think I was really interested. Once I got into the story, you know, and even beyond this premise, thinking about like how far I could push the pain of this couple. And, you know, I'm a sucker for redemption. So I think my stories often come around. Like I'm such a fan of Otessa Moshfegh and her work. And I think like she writes terrible characters kind of similar to me, but doesn't offer them redemption. And I'm really attracted to that too, but I just can't do it. Like I always gotta give my character something. And I think this story maybe offers that at a point.
Yeah, for a reader, redemption, you know, it can be wearing to read a lot of stories where there is no redemption, where it's just kind of bitter, you know, hard, grueling. I mean, you know, there's value and meaning in those stories, but there's something about seeing a character having an epiphany or being redeemed in some way that gives some relief to the reader. And I agree. I tend to prefer those kinds of stories. Not that they have to have happy endings, but just that the character learns something, right? That the character grows in some way. And you know, and that's certainly the case in pretty much all of your stories, I would say. And it was a really satisfying experience, but sad when I came to the end of the collection. I thought that, oh no, there's no more stories. Because I was reading it on my iPad and I was scrolling and I'm like, wait, where's the next story? And there wasn't one. And I was like, damn, well now I have to go read the other collections that Dustin has out there. So that's what I'm recommending to everybody. Please, you know, when Such a Good Man becomes available, look for it. His other collections are No Good for Digging, 100 Knuckled Fists, and the chapbook Secrets of the Wild. This has been such a pleasure, Dustin. Thank you so much for taking time out of your busy day to join me today. I really had a great time.
Well, and thank you, John. You're such great questions and a great talk. And I just love what you're doing with Short Story Today. So thank you for all the support you're giving to the literary community as well.
It keeps me going. I love it. So thank you for those kind words and keep on writing the good stuff and we'll stay in touch. All right. Take care, Dustin.
You too.
You'll find more information about Dustin's books, and links to his stories on his website, dustinmhoffman.com. And now we'll move on to the short story. Today I'll be reading Smoke at the End of the World, which will be included in the collection Such a Good Man, but was first published in Diagram. So here it is, Smoke at the End of the World by Dustin M. Hoffman. We smoked the houses out before they even existed. We smoked when they dug foundation, smoked when they poured concrete. We inhaled when they tossed up the studs and struts and cripples, held it in when the crane dropped the prefabbed A-frame rafters, and we exhaled finally only when the last nail landed. We smoked from rough plumb to toilet seat, circuit box to light switch, sheetrock to primer to top coat of eggshell candlewick white. We smoked until they caught us dropping ash onto the brand new carpet. That was the first sign, and we should have read the tobacco leaves that leaked from our flicked butts congregating in the street curbs. Not that knowing would have stopped anything, but at least we could have quit hoping, could have packed up and cut out. In September, all was normal. All of us clutching a tool handle or a ladder rung or a roll of insulation while our teeth clenched a cigarette butt. By October, as Michigan began its cold cruelties, there was Mark, the newly hired construction manager, standing on the freshly set bone-white driveway, wearing a white polo, fists against his hips and chest puffed, blonde as a Hitler youth. He said, "Hello, fellas. Grand to meet you, fellas. We'll be slamming out so many houses as we move this subdivision from phase 2 to phase 3, and then we'll tackle 1,000 more of these mothers together until the lumberyard runs out of 2x4s and we retire fat and rich." Nobody nodded to Mark. We kept on working and smoking and maybe dreaming a little about this new concept of ever having enough money to stop working. Then his smile dropped when he broke the news. "But fellas, sorry to say, no more smoking in the houses. At least not after the carpet's down. Homeowners want it smelling fresh, and so do the bosses. Our bosses, the builders." We consented minimally by some of us flicking our butts out the window. Sure, we supposed we could imagine how some wouldn't want their babies crawling through brand new Berber that smelled like second-hand contractor smoke. We tolerated the decree, save for the carpet crew, who later that evening filled Mark the construction manager's shiny white Silverado to the brim with piss-soaked padding scraps. It was a sight to see him opening his cab door to a deluge of blue pad springing forth. The rest of us still smoked most of the time, and most of the time was what mattered most. Few weeks later, Mark sneaked a secret meeting with the house painters to ask why their touch-ups weren't blending. "Perfect is impossible if you know how to look at a wall," they told him. "But couldn't it be the smoking?" Mark asked. "The tar tinting the walls just enough to mismatch the paint?" And yeah, there'd been that old guy's house, stacked with books and bedbugs and cockroaches, and he sat chain-smoking on his leather armchair like the king of pestilence while they painted around him. The walls had gone from white to brown, but that had been 13 years of exhaling smoke. Couple days of smoking in these new houses, no issue. "See, but maybe," Mark said, "I just want to help you boys do your job better. I'm here for you," he said. And then, poof, no more smoking after primer. Our doom should have been clear as the window pane that Mark inspected with the tip of his index finger. Just outside the window, the excavator boys and their yellow backhoes were missing. No exhaust, no new foundation holes, just the same trees spilling their dead red leaves. Our crews dropped from 7 days per week to 6. We were so relieved to finally have a day to drink our pay, to fuck our wives and boyfriends, maybe even go to church if one could find time for God. Too comfortable to notice what we should have feared. 1 day less need for us. But 6 12-hour days still filled the gutters and curbs and front lawns with cigarette butts. So many that Mark hired his high schooler cousin to sweep the street, a black-haired boy forever bent at our butts. From sun up to dusk, just like us. Inevitably, he started smoking too. And he'd be puffing and broom-pushing and every 20 minutes spitting his own butt into the shuffling pile. When Mark rolled up in that white Silverado and spotted his cousin boy smoking, he slapped the smoke out of his mouth. Mark marched into the nearest house, his face creased and ruddy. A wormy vein under his right eye pulsed. He promised us the next one caught smoking in a house after sheetrock was hung wouldn't see another contract. We couldn't resist goading him. Asked him about the insulation, about how maybe that pink fluffy fiberglass might absorb the smoke too, stink up the house from inside. "Goddamn right," he said. "No smoking after insulation, either. Might even be seeping into the copper and the PVC," we joked, "into the dark knots in the pine studs," which meant no smoking once frame went up. "What if it all started at the concrete, the very foundation corrupted from the start?" we asked. "No fucking smoking anywhere," Mark shouted and stormed out of the house and into his truck and down the subdivision road. We reverted to our natural wild state of smoking and worse. We ashed in the new carpets, floated butts in the toilets, ground them in the garbage disposals. We stashed butts atop door jams and between studs and inside circuit boxes. We challenged Mark's black-haired cousin boy to a smoke-off to see who could suck down a camel-wide filter fastest. And he beat a mason and a roofer before a painter set the subdivision record with a 54-second smoke. Mark's cousin boy went pale from all the nicotine, slipped it off in a dumpster full of carpet scraps. For the next few days, as the early snow flurries began, Mark's truck idled by on patrol, but he didn't stop. And no one told us where our next contracts would take us now that this sub was nearly complete. Every hour of continued silence punched us in the lungs. After a week went by with no Mark, all we had left were finished houses full of carpet and most of us leaning against our wheel wells waiting. Inside, no one smoked, as if our goodwill gesture might conjure Mark with a fistful of contracts. Pristine houses surrounded us, ready for market, built on spec. For the last 4 years, families herded in before a realtor could even show them. Our new job was watching the snow mounds build atop the doorsteps. The ground would freeze soon, and no more digging would happen. Somewhere, we prayed, awaited 100 holes for us. Finally, Mark's Silverado showed and slowed to a stop. He blew a plume of smoke out his window. He was sucking a fat cigar. "Congratulations," he said. "You've finished. You've built a house for every single person in America. In fact, maybe you've built 2 for each." Someone flicked a butt at his chrome rims. Mark puffed and his cigar cherry was splitting down the side. "So thanks for fucking me over, boys, by building all the houses Michigan will ever need," Mark said. "What the fuck am I going to do with a construction management degree and no more construction?" Then Mark puked out his window. It was red and laced with bright noodles, probably spaghetti or all his viscera. "Biggest assholes in America, you boys with your hammers and brushes," he said. "And we'll all remember who's to blame." Mark gunned it, peeling rubber against the fresh blacktop. Only the burnt smell lingered with us as we waited another week for Mark to deliver another contract. The builders ignored our calls. The black-haired cousin boy kept sweeping, though. Sweeping and waving. Paid by whom, we had no clue. The trade of cleaning up our mess was the last one left, and we hated him. December hit, and Christmas loomed, and we smoked outside the spec houses no one was buying. We smoked when the realtor showed up in her red skirt and green blazer to check on the houses and Windex her for sale sign. She ignored our collective exhales when no one showed up for the first open house or the 7th. We smoked while the first foreclosure sign went up. We smoked and watched that first family pack every possession into brown boxes and stash them in a U-Haul. A man in a wrinkled suit scraped Peterson's off the mailbox. Then the Gomez family left. The Piazzas hugged each other in the yard and cried, and we smoked and smoked. Foreclosure signs lined the street, every house we built now homes for ghosts. We broke into the bank-owned homes that we'd built. Mark's head would have exploded. We smoked inside each one. Whether saying goodbye or saying fuck you, it was a thing to do better than waiting for work that wouldn't come. Better than listening to the news talk about bubbles and subprimes and bailouts that wouldn't bail us out. After we couldn't buy Christmas presents, after we missed our own first mortgage payments, Mark's cousin still swept. Black-haired cousin boy remained long after Mark's truck had swerved away. He looked to us with his pleading 5-gallon bucket full of our cigarette butts. His work would last as long as we smoked, and we'd smoke for forever. We flicked still-flaming cherries at the cousin boy, the orange embers fireworking against his body. He tried to swat them off with his broom, but we were too many. We flicked into his arms and hands and face and hair. He shouted, and we lit more. We circled him, lighting and smoking and flicking, the cousin boy cursing us to hell, until one of us landed a butt into the neckline of his shirt. He wailed like a wild baby, swatted at an invisible burning, and then his black T-shirt began to dissolve in a slow smolder. He slapped at the bright hole of his pale chest, and our own bared lungs felt the new cold with him. Thank you, Dustin, for allowing us to read that compelling story. Well, that's the end of the episode. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. Please join us next week when our guest author will be Allison Mosquera du Temple. The music you hear at the beginning of each episode is by C.S. Fuqua, and the closing music is by Matt Hawkins. You can find out more about their music from a link on our homepage at shortstorytoday.com. You've been listening to Short Story Today, where we celebrate short stories and the authors who write them. Across the bridge of stories are
find you.